1557, Smart Modular Technologies.
May it please the Court, the primary issue in this appeal, particularly of the Patent Office and the Board's obviousness conclusion, is the Patent Office and the intervener's treatment of Claim 1's limitation of generating second set of chip select signals. In particular, that limitation states, generates a set of second chip select signals based at least in part upon values of said first chip select signals and a portion of the address signal. Now, the primary problem we have here is that the Patent Office and then the intervener applied the wrong claim construction standard. There is no explicit claim construction of the limitation generates. But here, the Patent Office and the intervener are applying the broadest reasonable interpretation. But the correct standard is the broadest reasonable interpretation in light of the specification. Now, the Patent Office found that on this memory circuit, essentially that if this first set of chip select signals was present at the input, they were necessarily used to generate the second set. And in fact, they argue that one of ordinary skill in the art would know that just the mere presence, you could mix them into any combination you wanted. Now, intervener changed that interpretation slightly. Intervener argued that as long as the first chip select signals have some involvement in generating the second chip select signals, this limitation is satisfied. Continuing, it is enough to conclude that the second chip select signals are based at least in part upon the values of S0 and S2, as the second chip select signals may be generated only when S0 and S2 are set to specific values. Now, this is incorrect and is apparent from the specification of the 295 patent. Figure 1, which is reproduced in the reply brief, page 7, shows what is labeled as a prior art device. Now, this is not prior art that was produced as a reference. This is prior art that the inventors acknowledged and then said they were making an improvement upon. And that prior art, and there's a call out on page 7, shows a first set of chip select signals as inputs. The rest of the patent, that would fulfill the interpretation of the Patent Office and the intervener. But the specification continues with figures 2 through 8 and with text on the inventor's improvement upon the prior art. And that improvement was specifically using the chip select signals with the address signals to determine, to generate the second set of chip select signals. Now this, we can go to the Patent Office and the intervener's argument with an analogy of a store. The decision to purchase a product is a logical decision, but a condition precedent is the store being open. You would never say that the decision to purchase an object is based upon the store being open. A condition precedent is not a basis for a decision. In electronics, we can analogize to a television set. The decision to change the channel of the television set from 4 to 7 is based upon the inputs from the viewer with the remote control and the circuit of the TV. It is not based upon the power supply from the wall, although that power supply is a necessary condition precedent and is an input to that television, but is not a part of the logical decision. Now here, the inventors identified the prior art, described the prior art in column one, described the uses of the chipsets in the prior art in column one, and then described their invention, the improvement. And what distinguishes claim one from that prior art is the combination, the inseparable combination, that the input chipsets must have different values based upon values and the generating step. That the chipsets are actually a part of the Boolean logic, a part of the decision on the second set of chipsets.
Of course, what a reference discloses is a question of fact. And we owe the Patent Office deference on that, don't we?
Claim interpretation is a question of law, which is reviewed.
Are we talking about what Takeda discloses, the reference?
No, I'm talking about what the 295 patent discloses. In page 7 of the reply brief, we've reproduced figure 1 from the 295 patent. And figure 1 is identified as prior art. It is described as prior art, and the specification describes it in the background of the invention, not in the detailed description or the description of the invention or the summary of the invention. So here are the inventors. This is completely separate from Takeda. Here the inventors didn't simply produce, you know, articles and patents which they knew about. They wrote a section that says, here is the prior art. So to interpret the claim, which is a question of law, reviewed de novo, you must do so, broadest reasonable interpretation, yes, but in light of the specification. So I submit that a proper interpretation must, if possible, exclude that prior art. And the language here, the critical language of Claim 1 that excludes that prior art is a set of chipset signals, the values of the chipset signals, and generates based upon, based at least in part upon, the values of those chipset signals.
So you're saying an inventor in his application can characterize the prior art in such a way as to remove the deference that we give to the prior art as determined by the PTO.
Claim construction must be in light of the prior art. So in claim construction, which is a question of law.
Claim construction is the plain language of the claim in light of the patent specification.
Yes, in light of the specification.
But here you're talking about the specification characterizing the prior art.
Yes, that's right.
And you're saying that overrides what the patent office interprets the prior art to say.
Yes, it does, because the inventors in their application conceded that the prior art was the prior art, and they had no right to claim that prior art. So there's no question of fact there. The inventors have said this prior art that we're describing here, that we've put in figure one, is prior art. So there's no finding of fact there. And this is just completely established. The claim interpretation, which must be in view here of the specification, is a question of law, which is reviewed de novo. Now, if I may move to the second significant point, and that is the burden shifting. MPEP 706 requires that in examination, the standard is a preponderance of the evidence. Okay. There are two burdens. There's the burden of production, which may shift. But there's the burden of persuasion. And it's established in reexamination. Please remember, this is an inter partes reexamination. It was filed the day before IPR became effective. The burden of persuasion may never shift. Now, here in the record, there is no finding. There's no statement from the Patent Office of establishment of unpatentability by a preponderance of the evidence. They never said that. But they did make statements of burden shifting. For example, Appendix 84, Smart's expert provides no persuasive rebuttal. Not no rebuttal, no persuasive rebuttal. Appendix, page 7.
I don't understand. So if they had said provides no rebuttal, that would have been okay? I don't understand what you're...
If you establish
a prima facie case, you assume the burden of production therefore shifts. So does not the burden of production require that the rebuttal be persuasive? Yeah.
There are two parts to answer that. The first, the establishment of the prima facie case does not mean that it's been established by preponderance of the evidence. Second, the burden of production may shift, but that's not what the Patent Office said. They didn't say Smart's expert did not provide rebuttal. They said persuasive rebuttal.
So you're saying that they shifted the burden, and therefore if the patent owner provides rebuttal, even if it's not persuasive, that should carry the day because the burden is on the office?
If the patent owner has produced rebuttal, they have carried the burden of production. But that
and then the decision maker says, yeah, you carried the burden of production, but you weren't very convincing. The prima facie case overwhelms the response that you made to it.
The problem there is the
prima facie case. And so you get to sit down.
Well, there the problem is the prima facie case. What it should be is it should be, yes, you have, assuming that the patent owner has come forward. Next step should be, you have come forward. We look at what the patent office has said, what the petitioner has said. We now look at what you came back with. We now find, because and give reasons, by a preponderance of the evidence. But they didn't say that. There's more instances. Patent owner has not
demonstrated. After the board said you didn't provide a convincing rebuttal.
What
was the next conclusion on the issue?
The burden is never on the patent owner to burden persuasion.
I understand that. The burden's on the challenger. The challenger made a challenge. The decision maker said, okay, your duty now is to respond to the challenge. You respond to the challenge. What did the decision maker say next? The
decision maker says this in review.
The challenger were, and challenger was insufficient.
They would say that in view of all the evidence presented, right, by a preponderance of the evidence, which
is
the patent office didn't say.
Missing sentence? Is that what was missing?
Well, you know, the missing sentence is critical. It's critical for two reasons. Number one, that's the first instance we have of language.
You agree that it's a missing sentence that didn't describe what happened is the missing sentence.
The sentence is missing.
Yeah, but what the result was, the rejection of your attempt to overwhelm the prima facie case, means that the decision maker decided that your response was not meritorious.
That was a long question, and there's a critical point where I disagree. There's no duty to overcome the prima facie case, because the prima facie case is not establishment by preponderance of the evidence. Now, it's not directly on point. It is an IPR, but in the Ray Magnum Oil Products.
It's rules of engagement. If a person makes a prima facie argument, and the person to whom the argument made defaults, doesn't respond.
Yes.
What happens then?
Failure to carry the burden, the shifted burden of production.
Now, what happens in an instance where a prima facie case is made and no response is given? Doesn't the prima facie case survive?
That was because there was no attempt at the burden of production, which we concede may shift.
So what's the difference between no attempt at the burden of production and a failed attempt?
The difference is, well, it is precedent. You must make an attempt at the production. But if the total evidence does not rise to a preponderance of the evidence, then the case has not been made.
Okay, we're into your rebuttal, so why don't we hear from the government?
May it please the court. On the first issue that counsel spoke about, the claim language requires that the second chip select signals are generated based at least in part upon the values of the first chip select signals. If you look at Takeda's figure 2, it shows that the first chip select signals, S0 and S2, are input into the bank control unit and are part of the generation of the second control signals, second chip select signals. So I don't really understand how you could say that the first chip select signals don't have a part in the generation. While it's true that Takeda shows that S0 and S2 must be low for the second chip select signals to be generated, that still means that the second chip select signals are based at least apart on the values of S0 and S2. They have to be low. Both signals have to be low for the generation of the second signals. So that's enough in the PTO's view to find that the based at least in part upon language in claim one is satisfied. And I really don't think that this is a claim construction case. It's kind of surprised me to hear opposing counsel couch this whole case in terms of claim construction. If you look at the briefs.
Was that a new twist on, I didn't recall that particular characterization of the issue in his brief.
Yes, I mean, it shows up a little, like I guess, in the reply brief on page 7, which he cited to. But this has not been a claim construction case before the board. It wasn't a claim construction case in his opening brief. So this was really just a case about what the prior art discloses and whether the board's decision is supported by substantial evidence. And I think that the board cited portions of the reference itself. The board cited to the expert testimony, and the board cited to these other technical documents, the JEDEC documents, to support its decision. On the second point about the burden shifting, as Judge Clevenger spoke about, this is just the prima facie case.
You think the board could be a little more articulate, a little more careful in the way it writes its opinion so as not to alarm the patentees the way they've done it in this case?
I mean, I think the board could always, you could always find things to...
You got some boilerplate language for starters. A little paragraph that said, you know, there's a prima facie case and we're not shifting burdens. There's a burden of production comes back. And when we decide that the burden of production wasn't, the response wasn't sufficient, that means that substantial evidence supports the yada yada. I mean, the board opinions are pretty skinny when it comes down to explaining how this all functions.
I would agree that in an ideal world, the board could lay the prima facie case out in perfect clarity, but that doesn't always happen, and I don't think that's necessary in this case. I think it was clear from reading the decisions that the board looked at the evidence offered by the requester, found...
We have opinions of this court, presidential opinions, where we have taxed the board for shifting a burden.
Correct, and I don't think... The burden of persuasion, the ultimate burden of persuasion was shifted here. Like I was saying, that the board looked at the evidence offered by the requester, found that the prima facie case was satisfied. And
I don't think you did either, but I just think, you know, we have a sort of an institutional relationship with the board because this is the only place the board comes to get reviewed. And from time to time, we comment on how things, the system might be improved.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'll be happy to go back to the board and, you know, make the request that it...
Well, that's okay, but there is one misstep that you seem to recognize and try to gloss over or explain away in the brief, and that's with the use of the language equally plausible.
Yeah.
Because that clearly suggests in our nomenclature that the evidence is an equipoise. And if that were the case, this case shouldn't have gone the direction exactly it went. So you explain that. I may or may not be satisfied with that explanation, but there's a little bit of a specific misstep there, right?
Sure. I think that the use of equally plausible is just a misstatement here. This is specifically talking about the two experts describing the nomenclature of signals. So the question here is whether S0 and S2 are this, just two copies of the same signal, and both experts agree that when you have two copies of the same signal, you want to give them different names for various reasons, but that's agreed upon. And so the patentee's expert says, well, okay, you give them different names like S0 and S2. And now the other expert, the requester's expert, said, no, actually there's a kind of standard in the industry where you give them the same name with a different suffix. And so the 295 patent actually has an example of that where there's a signal titled RCS0A and RCS0B. And those are two separate lines, but just copies of the same signal. And so the board is looking at those two things, and it finds that Dr. Sayre, the requester's expert on this point, finds his testimony is more persuasive. Now, it uses this language equally plausible, but it's not saying that it finds the evidence, you know, in equipoise on this specific issue. If you read it, you know, the bottom of page, appendix page 85 to the top of appendix page 86, it's clear that the board is buying Dr. Sayre's opinion over Mr. Slimmer's opinion. There's nothing further?
Thank you.
Thank you.
2 points. First, on Takeda, you know, counsel said that the chip selects were present at the input. But the problem is that contradicts the language of Takeda. Takeda says, appendix 192, the third line, it says, decodes A12, A13, performs bank selection. It bases the determining step on address signals only. That is the critical difference between the 295 patent, claim one, and Takeda. Takeda does not at any point disclose using the chip select signals to decode the second set of chip select signals. And intervener's argument requires ignoring the explicit language of Takeda. Now, Judge Prost raised the equipoise issue. Here, the critical issue is that the board, patent office, did not make a finding, explicit finding, of establishment of unpatentability by preponderance of the evidence. When coupled with the instances, the equipoise, we discussed persuasive rebuttal, there's also patent owner has not demonstrated that the Takeda's S0 and S2 are a single drive signal. The failure to find by a preponderance of the evidence and state that, coupled with burden shifting language, is indicative that the did in fact shift the burden and does not require us to try to read the minds of the examiner and the ALJs. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning. It's 10:00 a.m.